3. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Virginia, and I've been your host for today. Please stay tuned.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, where we spell theater with an RE at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, April 7th. And we're going to do some things a little differently tonight. Waiting for many big theater productions to open up later this month, with shows from Black Theater Workshop, Centaur, Siegel, and Infinitheater, to name a few. And I'll take you behind the scenes of those productions over the next few weeks. But in the meantime, I've got some different kinds of arts goings on to share with you. I'll speak again with musician Norman Navratsky, who is organizing a fundraiser for relief efforts in Ukraine and Poland.
Many of us have not played for 2.5 years for good reasons, because of COVID. That we're coming together for this particular purpose kind of invests it with a special magic for us, that we know we're playing for an amazing cause and that this money is going directly to people in need now.
And a special treat, Aussie rocker Nick Cave was in town this weekend to perform and also open a biographical exhibit, a fascinating show whether or not you're familiar with his genre-bending rock with his bands like The Birthday Party and The Bad Seeds.
There's a lot of reasons to be happy at the moment, especially a band on tour, because by that stage, well, apart from anything, we've managed to get through now two tours of one of England and some of Europe and one of North America without catching COVID.
We'll hear from the woman who sorted through boxes and boxes of Nick Cave's ephemera to produce this show. We'll also take a moment to remember the life of Boris Brott. Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, the land also known as Chuchage in Ganiagahaga and Muniang in Anishinaabemowin, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, April 14th, 2022. On tonight's show, my guests. Audrey Zina Mandiela, Director of Pipeline.
I'm trusting that with the kind of piece, the kind of immersive artistic experiences that we've crafted with this production, that people will leave the theater talking not only about the subjects, but talking about the fact that we need to be talking to each other beyond language barriers.
Miranda Rose Hall, author of A Play for the Living in a Time of Extinction.
And so he was like, we got to deal with this, or else future generations are going to look back at us and say, were they completely deranged? The ecosystem was collapsing all around them and they couldn't figure out how to tell a story about it. Like, what's wrong with them?
And meet Sandy Tugwood and Noah Nielsen, two circus artists who met and fell in love in Montreal, presenting their very first show together.
I grew up in a little tent circus in Western Australia. And
I grew up in the tent circus in Vermont.
Yeah, and we're like on the other side of the world from one another, but we're just kind of having this very niche but very similar upbringing in like, yeah, dusty tent circus, slightly traditional, a little bit punk, like...
Before we begin, a few updates. The Quebec Culture Minister, Nathalie Roy, announced over $225 million in funding for the arts sector to help with pandemic recovery. This was announced earlier this week on Sunday, actually. And the other bit of news is that Sisyphus by Le Mieux Pilon 4D Art has won an illustrious prize, the Conseil des Arts de Montréal's 36th Grand Prix. Victor Pilon set up this incredible performance art piece where he was shoveling mounds of sand, just tons of it, every single day for about 8 hours a day, I believe. And this was happening in the bowels of the Olympic Stadium. It was a meditation on grief. He had lost his partner, his longtime partner, in a car accident. And so he shoveled sand and went back and forth, and people could go inside this big black cavernous room and watch him do this. And occasionally he would reach out and pass the shovel to someone and they would help carry the sand. I sat down on one of the last remaining days in the run of Sisyphus and I watched for over an hour. And at some point I tossed the sand myself with a shovel. It was moving. And there was microphones set up all over the space. So the echo of the shovel hitting the sand getting tossed back over his back, being dragged along the ground was just very riveting. And it was free. So you could go and enter. And there was photos that tracked the progress of the performance through the several weeks that he was doing it. So he has won $30,000. The secondary prize, the jury prize, as they call it, which is $10,000, goes to the producers of the Nuit d'Afrique Festival. So congratulations to the winners this year of the Grand Prix du Conseil des Arts de Montréal. The 36th annual prize goes to Victor Pilon for his work Sisyphus, which was just a momentous show. And if it ever gets remounted, or if you ever get a chance to see photos from it, I suggest you go for it, because it was a moving, moving piece of art. Now on with our show. Before Dominique Morisseau started winning accolades like the MacArthur Genius Grant for her playwriting, she started out performing poetry in her hometown of Detroit. And that's a cool connection in my mind for the guest we're about to welcome here on Upstage. Morisseau's play Pipeline explores what is known as the school-to-prison pipeline, a sociological phenomenon where Black and POC students are forced from school and into the prison system. We meet Nia, a public school teacher who values education and challenges and values her students, but she wants to make sure her own son goes to a private school in the hopes of ensuring Omari's future success. But will a stunning turn of events upend his education, his place at school, and his future? The show was an off-Broadway hit, debuting in 2017. Canadian writer and theater maker Audrey Zina Mandiela is the woman entrusted to direct Dominique's vision in a new production for Black Theater Workshop, co-presented by La Manufacture and opening tonight at La Licorne. Now, BTW just celebrated its 50th anniversary as the longest-running Black theater company in Canada, which is roughly how long Audrey has been a force on the theater scene in both this country and on the world stage. And her own roots, like Dominique Morisseau, the playwright, her own roots are in poetry. Besides having Audrey aboard, this production is also very special because it will be presented in French and in English with the exact same cast. The English run debuts tonight and runs until April 23rd at La Licorne, and then the cast switches to French April 26th to May the 8th. And remember, this is the same cast, they're just changing languages. Mishka Levine translated this work, and this was a brand new experience for Audrey as a director. I spoke with her earlier today about the bilingual component of Pipeline and the key messages in Morisseau's work. This is our conversation. Welcome, Audrey, to Upstage. It's so lovely to have you here. Thanks for taking the time.
I am very, very glad to be here and in Montreal here on this maybe rainy day.
It is a rainy day. You have so much experience in the theater world, so maybe this is old hand to you, but what is opening week like for you as a director? Is it jittery? Is it exciting? Is it, you know, are you just chill at this point?
Chill. There is absolutely no point in this whole process of rehearsing that's a chill time.
Okay.
Seriously, you know, I am not an early morning riser, and even on the days when we don't have to be early in rehearsal, I am up at 6 o'clock. And so that, you know, that just tells really how, what the tension is, you know. There's constant artistic and creative tension flowing, which is all good, you know, but it makes for less sleep.
Yeah.
And a lot of jitters, as you mentioned. And this opening week is, you know, particularly fraught with tensions and nerves and real jitters around fine-tuning, you know, mm-hmm. fine-tuning both on technical and on the acting levels, you know. And so everybody's tired and frayed and luckily today, when we're recording today, is I've given the actors their day off so they can rest up, you know, because the show feels like it's in a really good position.
I'm jumping in here just to mention that part of the interview was scrambled because of a recording glitch. So we go now to my next question, which was about the script by Dominique Morisseau. A few years back, BTW then director Quincy Armorer asked Audrey to take a look at the play for them potentially to co-direct it together. What did Audrey make of the script when she first read it?
For me, like I said, it's an extremely poetic and very nuanced script. Nuanced in the sense that the kind of characters that she's drawn in the storytelling, you really have to listen to them and you see them and you care about them. And they're not big arcs, not big stereotypic people that you see in pop culture or other cultural, you know, kind of renditions of characterscapes. They are very real. They're people you may know. They're people in your family, and they're lovable. They're hateable, and they're all of that, you know. So I really am glad that Quincy did get in touch with me to work on this piece, and I'm glad the follow through happened with Black Theatre Workshop in association with La Licorne.
We meet Nia. She's a single mom. She's a teacher. And she's working really hard to put her son not in the public school system, but in the private school system. That's a deliberate choice. Can you tell me more about Nia and the sacrifices she's making for her son and what she's really concerned about?
Yeah, for sure. One of the things is I never, you know, I see writings and descriptions of Nia as a single mother, and I never, never describe her as a single mother, you know. She is.
And why is that?
She's a mother within a community, like many, many mothers who may be on their own, but that doesn't mean that they're single. They may be a single person as far as how we define marriage and partnerships, you know, but she is a mother, a Black mother, who is actually co-parenting her son with her ex. That for me doesn't make her single and doesn't make this experience of mothering a singular kind of matrix, you know. And she is a well-experienced and very passionate teacher in an urban school who has chosen well, actually, I won't even say chosen, who was forced to send her son to private school because that was not her choice place. And, you know, and it's talked about in the story. And, you know, and then she finds out that, no, that was a mistake because it's not fixing any of what they thought it would fix. It's not really steering him away from the school to prison pipeline. Just very incidental and innocent things will get him pushed back into that. And all is lost. Anyway, all that you think you're saving him from, you end up not by just through simple, everyday teenage things. You know, the shit that teenagers do that get them wrapped, you know, that get them, what do I say?
Gets them in trouble.
And very little trouble. You know, you get your allowance cut off, or you have to stay home for a while, or you give up your phone, or, you know, those kinds of things. That, those kinds of incidents that are happening to him literally will get his life cut off, you know?
You referenced pipeline. The school to prison pipeline is being something that happens in all over the world. And I think I would assume maybe Canadians, people Absolutely. Who are not part of the Black community would assume, well, this probably just happens in the United States.
Very much how the narrative goes.
Is private school seen as like a way to bypass that completely, as like a safer option?
Absolutely, because private school is supposed to turn you into a new being, a one that offers certain enjoyment of privileges, but really, you know, depending who you are, where you come from, and what you go home to, those privileges dissipate very, very, you know, they're very ethereal, they dissipate very quickly. And especially too, you know, when you even before you become an adult, but very much when you become an adult too, no matter what kind of private schools you may have been through, you know, you face the same challenges.
But Nia, we can tell, is really eager to shield him from that. And I'm just wondering if Omari is fully aware, at least in the beginning, of what exactly the stakes are and what Nia, his mom, is trying to do.
You know what? I would say yes, because as I know how I grew up as a Black child, you know, and we grow up knowing knowing the sacrifices that our parents are making, what their dreams are, what they want for us, why they want those things for us, and what they do in order to achieve it. So we know the stakes. That doesn't mean that we live by them, though. Yeah. That doesn't mean that we carry them every minute of our day and, you know, are circumspect, you know, act circumspect and accordingly. We try to live our lives as just people out there, you know, kids out there growing up, you know, attending mostly to ourselves and our own individual needs. And, you know, that's us, that's kids growing up in the world. So no, he does know what she's sacrificing, but it's all part of the part of the game. It's all part of the living and the growing up.
That is the voice of Audrey. That is the voice of Audrey Zina Mandiela, who is directing Pipeline on, as of this week, at La Licorne, a BTW production co-presented with La Manufacture. And the thing that really jazzes me as well about this show is that it's being presented in English, then in French. It was translated by Mishka Leving. Have you worked on a project like this before where there's a French and English component?
No, I have not. And I, you know, I may have mentioned before, I don't even really speak French. I am in the room full of people who are bilingual in this way. And I myself can claim bilingualism. I am fluent in Jamaican and fluent in English. But French, I can get by, particularly when I'm listening, less so talking. But my artistic, my associate director is Tamara Brown, who has spent many years here in working and living in Montreal. And she
local
is,
legend.
Yes, you know, and I'm so pleased to be working, really happy working with Tamara. We've been working actually since last year. When I first auditioned folks for this piece, you know, I chatted with Tamara and said, this piece, you're going to work on it with me. I want you. Us in the room is what's going to make this work. And she's worked on some other pieces in between then and now with me. And I think we really, really jammed well on this. And I am so glad. I'm really happy.
Well, I'm so impressed that this is going to, you know, reach an even wider audience because it's going to be in English and in French.
Absolutely. And, you know, for me, maybe the biggest, there are two things really big for me with the fact that it's in both English and French. Yeah. One, because BTW has not really done a lot of work or much work in French, you know, which means that from reaching some of the Black audiences here, that has been cut off, you know. So you have this space here now where a lot of Black audiences that need and will yearn to see and experience this piece can actually come and be immersed in the French version. But there's also the wider Francophone speaking community here in Montreal that don't usually access works, Black stories, you know, and Black artists' work. This will give a chance for that. And so I'm trusting that with the kind of piece, the kind of immersive artistic experiences that we've crafted with this production, that people will leave the theater talking not only about the subjects, but talking about the fact that we need to be talking to each other beyond language barriers.
That's so beautifully said. There's nothing more I can add to that. It's been such a pleasure getting to know you and to hear more about your career and the work that you've put into this show. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Sarah. This was a wonderful interview. Nice and relaxed, too.
That's what we do here on Upstage. Everything is chill, like we were saying right off the top. Not chill like putting on a show, but this is the chill part for you.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
That was Audrey Zina Mandiela, director of Pipeline. The show is a Black Theater Workshop production co-presented by La Manufacture. It was written by Dominique Morisseau, and it opens officially tonight at Théâtre La Licorne in English. That run goes until April 23rd. And then the play then runs April 26th to May the 8th in French with a translation, a new one by Mishka Laving. The talented bilingual cast includes Jean Bernard, Jenny Brizard, Gloria Mampuya, Annie Pascal, Schubert, Pierre-Louis, and Gregory Eve. You can visit lalicorne.com for your tickets. That's LALICORNE. And check out blacktheaterworkshop.ca for more information about Pipeline and other upcoming productions. In just a moment, a member of the BTW's Artist Mentorship Program is starring in a brand new show, and we're going to learn more about it in just a moment. I'm Sarah DeAy. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come on the show, Circus, a love story. Two students come to Montreal to study at L'École Nationale du Cirque, one about to graduate, the other just starting their academic career. They meet, they fall in love, and now they are debuting a show together titled Simply Sandy and Noah. Stay tuned.
I've never been able to sit in an audience with people experiencing the play, which is, you know, the bread and butter of writing for live performance. You understand what you've made by sitting in an audience and, you know, feeling when they're leaning in, when they're falling asleep, you know, hopefully not falling asleep.
That is the voice of Miranda Rose Hall speaking about the magic of sitting through a live performance. After so much pandemic isolation, the writer is very excited to be coming to Montreal to sit through the Canadian premiere of her lauded work, A Play for the Living in a Time of Extinction. It's easy to feel alarmed about the state of the planet. A recent report by climate scientists suggests we are literally running out of time to take action in order to curb global warming. But Miranda's tone here in this play is softer, taking a warm, funny look at the climate crisis while trying to strike an optimistic tone. Naomi, the hero, is in a panic when she realizes her play about climate change is about to start, but the actors are nowhere to be found. So Naomi carries on, finding a way around this massive roadblock, talking about various phases of extinction with both humor and hope. The play was commissioned back in 2018 by Lubdub Theatre Company, where Miranda is a founding member. The play was a finalist for the Susan Smith Blackburn Prize last year, and it's getting ready to be performed all across Europe in the next couple of months. But first, of course, Centaur audiences will be the first in Canada to see this monologue about the environment and the planet. The wonderful actress Warona Setswaelo is set to play Naomi. As I mentioned earlier, she is not only a performer, but a mentor through Black Theatre Workshop, as well as Imago Theatre. The show is directed by Rose Plotek, who has recently served as a curator for the Wildside Festival at Centaur. And Miranda Rose Hall is the woman who wrote the play. I spoke with her, reaching her in Baltimore earlier this week. Miranda, welcome to Upstage. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. This is such a treat.
It's so lovely to have you. It was so strange that I was reading through the notes from the theater, Centaur, and realizing opening our main season, a play for living in a time of extinction. And I thought to myself, like, that feels so funny. It's April. This is the first play of the season. Like, how does that make any sense? And then I was like, oh my goodness. Yes, we are still living in a pandemic. It's a strange time. What have things been like for you over the last couple of years as to how it relates to your work?
Well, it's a weird time to be making theater. but I think the pandemic has been a little gentler on writers than on actors, because it's easier to write at home than it is to act or design or, you know, direct at home. But it's been such a weird, sad time. And so being able to, you know, first as a, you know, citizen of the world, but then as a theater artist. And so it's really special to be able to actually have a production happening. And it's always exciting to have a production, but it makes me feel all the luckier to have it in a pandemic.
Must be a bit bittersweet, I guess.
Yeah. Although this is really special because I'll be able to come to Canada and sit in an audience with real people. And for this play in particular, that is going to be a very significant experience, because I've now had several productions of this play and I've never been able to sit in an audience with people experiencing the play, which is, you know, the bread and butter of writing for live performance. You understand what you've made by sitting in an audience and, you know, feeling when they're leaning in, when they're falling asleep, you know, hopefully not falling asleep, but when they're laughing, or when you can feel how your play is working, when you feel how connected a group of living people is to the thing happening on stage. And it's been weird not to have that.
In normal circumstances, when the lights go up or the curtains go up and you're in the audience and it's your show, do you have this like moment of like, sharpen, take a breath, paying attention to everybody around you as opposed to what's on stage?
Yeah, you know, normally I have to wear dark colors in case I, you know, sweat. I get very nervous. It's hard to sit there and just take it in casually. But I guess by the time we open, it's sort of out of my hands at that point. I feel it's a different experience when you're in previews and there's still some time to make adjustments as needed.
So we'll have to look out for you wearing the lady dressed all in dark colors on opening night later this month.
That'll be me.
So it is a monologue. We open by meeting Naomi, who's walking us through a nightmare or living through a nightmare right off the top. Can you tell me a little bit about this character?
So Naomi is a very smart, very capable, very devoted woman who is part of a theater company with two of her best friends. And I don't want to give too much away, but she expects to be behind the scenes. When we meet her, she expects to be behind the scenes, and instead she's thrust on stage. And the play is about how she deals with that. And in large part, I think the overall story is kind of also the basics of the theater. How do we make something out of nothing? How do we conjure a feeling between one person and many people? And how do we figure out what we're trying to say and what we mean, and how can we communicate that in a way that feels right and in a way that can be heard?
Yeah, how effective can it be? How do you get that message across? Really rings true to me. I'm speaking with Miranda Rose Hall, the playwright of A Play for the Living in a Time of Extinction, coming to Centaur later this month. And Miranda, you'll be in the audience, which is very exciting. We were just talking about that. I'm curious that you talked about the Naomi and getting her message out. What led you to start thinking about that? That just kind of stuck out to me, is how to find a path forward, but also how to share something with the wider world effectively.
This play really traces its roots back to 2018 when I myself have a small theater company. It's called Lub Dub Theater Company. We're based out of New York, and we're a group of longtime friends. And as a company, we read a book called The Great Derangement by a writer named Amitav Ghosh, who wrote this book as a call to writers of fictional narrative work. So I think he mostly was thinking about novelists, but I included myself in that group. And The Great Derangement is really a question to fiction writers saying, why are we not writing about climate chaos? Why are we living in a time of total disaster, of crisis, of emergency, and somehow it is not showing up in our fictional work? We're not allowing ourselves and our audiences to process the immensity of our time through the lens of fictional story, and it's being relegated for whatever reason to the work of nonfiction and to the work of science fiction. And so he's like, we got to deal with this, or else future generations are going to look back at us and say, were they completely deranged? The ecosystem was collapsing all around them, and they couldn't figure out how to tell a story about it. Like, what's wrong with them? that book really went straight into my heart.
And yeah.
And as a company, we decided we've got to try to respond. And that's the jumping off point for A Play for the Living. So I think that personally for me, and within the story for our dear Naomi, we're both trying to figure out, how do I tell a story about something that I don't know how to talk about, or how do I figure out how to talk about this thing that is so complex and mind-bending to me?
You're a writer, that's your trade. When the pandemic kind of erupted, people were like, wow, we're going to have so many novels and plays, like just talking about isolation and about people's great revelations during the pandemic. I think there was a collective kind of thing where editors were like, please, no, do not send me your pandemic plays. and that was like an immediate reaction to what was going around the world with us. But as you point out, as Amitav Ghosh was writing, why are we not talking about the eco crisis? Do you have a theory or a sense of why that might be?
I think that when you really start to dig into climate crisis, pretty quickly it becomes everything. And the scale of a global emergency is just very hard for the brain to understand. It psychologically, we struggle with this scale of disaster. And there's a term called hyper object, which means that it's actually just too big for our poor puny minds to make sense of. And the immediate response when faced with something so intimidating as a hyper object is to just like sort of shut down and run away. And, you know, I was feeling that a lot as I was working on this play. And I thought, my God, if I'm feeling that urge to just shut down and bury my head in the sand, or, you know, shut down and go escape into something more pleasant, and I'm actually trying to deal with this, then I can only imagine what everybody, anyone else would be feeling. So I think it's the root of the desire to turn away, I think, is love and sadness. We just instinctually love the world. We love our communities. We love, you know, our family. We don't want to die, and we don't want the place that we live to disappear. And I think the sadness and the rage about that makes it difficult to connect sometimes. At the very least, that's, I think, a very generous read of it that I think is true.
Well, I think you put it really, really well. It's complicated, but it comes back down to kind of like, it's immense, and it's also touching something super close to our hearts. That is the voice of Miranda Rose Hall. She is the playwright of A Play for the Living in a Time of Extinction. I keep worrying that I'm going to put one word out of place. It is a bit, it's, to me, it's a bit of a mouthful.
There are a lot of words. Yeah, there are a lot of words, but you're doing a great job so far.
Thank you so much. Well, coming up with the title of a play, like, how does that happen for you? Like, or does it come to you organically, or do you always have to have the title before you start writing, or did someone suggest this one?
Oh, I think I wrote the very first draft of this play not knowing what the title would be. And this came about maybe for the first draft of the play. I want to make sure. I think that the title of a play is the first promise that you make to an audience in terms of what they should expect from what they're about to see. And so I want people to not to be blindsided by what they walk into.
So they kind of know a little bit of what to expect. So yeah. This play is now coming to Canada. As we mentioned, you'll be in the audience, and it's going to tour all over Europe, which is very exciting. It's been shortlisted for the Susan Smith Blackburn Prize. What's this like to get this acclaim for something that you've been working on? That is, something has come out of a really serious question. It's also a monologue. It's not like a big, wide sweeping play as well. What's that feeling like for you?
Quite surreal. It's a dream come true. It's the highlight of my career, I think. And it's just been so special to have so many people in conversation with me about this work. And you know, the play began, as all my plays do, in solitude and isolation at my desk, and I'm like, oh my God, will this ever mean anything to anybody else? And it's kind of a fluke of timing in a way. I, you know, because I did start writing it in 2018, and it is a play about mortality, and it is a play about existential crisis, and there really are not many technical requirements, and it's a play for one person. So I didn't set out to write a play that would be conducive to pandemic producing. But in the end, by the, you know, the way timing, the world works and timing works, that ended up being the kind of play that people were looking for.
Well, congratulations again for hitting that sweet spot of having people responding to your the words that you've put on paper. It must be so exciting for you. You said it was the highlight of your career, but I'm sure there's many highlights to come. Just a very quick last question about the process. Now that the play is out in the world, you're gearing up to see it. Maybe not see it literally, but it's going to be presented. Someone noted this, that it's going to be in over 10 countries, you know, by 2024. So for you as an artist, like mentally, are you very much living in Naomi's world, or are you already thinking like, what is the next thing I'm going to wow the world with?
Oh, thank you for assuming that it will wow, the next thing I write will wow anybody.
Why not?
I think that I stopped over the last year. I've kind of arrived at a final version of the play. And so whenever that starts to happen, of course, I always start wondering what comes next. So I'm wading through the first drafts of a couple of commissions at the moment, which will make it extra special to sit and enjoy a play that's already figured out what it's trying to be. But yeah, I'll be keeping up with this as it moves through Europe. And then, you know, sitting down at my writing desk and banging my head against the wall by myself until I have something to show somebody else.
Miranda, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to join Upstage.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Sarah.
That was Miranda Rose Hall, the author of A Play for the Living in a Time of Extinction. She will be in Montreal for the Canadian launch of her play at Centaur Theatre April 26th. It runs until May 15th. Directed by Rose Plotek, with Warona Setsuaelo delivering the monologue as Naomi. The show wraps up Centaur's 53rd season, and in a sign of the unusual times we are living in, it's the theatre's first main stage production of 2022. Tickets are now on sale at centaurtheatre.com, box office 514-288-3161. There will be show talkbacks on Sunday, May 8th and Thursday, May 12th. Miranda and the creative team will join a pre-show conversation before the performance on April 28th. And Miranda will be in conversation with artistic director Ida Holmes on April 30th after the matinee. I'm Sarah DeAy, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week.
BTW and live theater is back. Black Theater Workshop and La Manufacture present Pipeline. We are back after 2 years with a dual language presentation of the off-Broadway hit Pipeline by Dominique Morisseau, translation by Mishka Lavigne. Pipeline shares the story of Nia, a single mother and teacher dedicated to the success of her students and her teenage son Omari. Tensions are mounting at his school, and Nia must find a way to rediscover her connection with her son and his connection with himself. Pipeline will be presented at Théâtre La Licorne from April 12th to 23rd in English and April 26th to May 8th in French. For tickets, call 514-523-2246 or visit théâtrelalicorne.com. This is a Black Theatre Workshop production and a CKUT co-presentation.
Now for a circus love story. Sandy Tugwood grew up in Margaret River, a town on the western coast of Australia. Noah Nielsen grew up just south of Montreal in Montpelier, Vermont. They were both circus kids growing up, and ultimately as adults, they came to Montreal to study at L'École Nationale du Cirque. She specializes in aerials and he is a juggler. After stints with major companies like Cirque du Soleil, the Les Sept Doigts de la Main, and Circa, the young couple is warming up to present their very first show together, which they've simply titled Sandy and Noah. You can hear some of the music playing here. They'll perform their abstract physical theater piece three times next week at La Chapelle Scène Contemporaine. It's a riff on the Western with two characters coming into contact and attempting to function together through oppositional push and pull. Montreal is the first place they'll perform before taking the show on the road later this year. I spoke with Sandy and Noah earlier this week. Welcome, Sandy and Noah, to Upstage. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you
for having us.
So this must be exciting, launching a brand new troupe. Can you, if you're a duo, can we call you guys a troupe, or do you prefer the word duo? You're launching something new at this point in the pandemic. Congratulations.
Yeah, let's call us a duo.
How does it feel to be launching something new like this?
It's pretty exciting. I think, I'm mostly excited and a little bit nervous because it is our debut, like, full-length show in Montreal. So I'm feeling, mostly excited and a little bit of apprehension about how it's going to all, like, technically pan out.
Yeah, very excited about this project. We've got some fun stuff that we've been working with for a bit now. It's some stuff from, like, other work we were doing. It's kind of like a mix of different phases, and we're excited to have it all together.
You both met at L'École Nationale du Cirque, but you're both not from Montreal. You're from Australia, Sandy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm from Western Australia. There's like a small town that has a tiny little circus in it, and I grew up doing circus and surfing.
Was it hard to make that decision to go all the way around the other side of the world to study circus professionally?
Yeah, because where I live, like, was really... I was really like on this path of surfing, and then I was like, oh, I really want to do circus, but then I have to move to this freezing cold country to do it. But it was really worth it because, like, Montreal is such a really awesome city.
Have you gone surfing down at the Lachine Rapids?
No, but I've seen people do it. It looks dicey.
fair enough. You've come from not quite so far away, Noah, but you still had to move to Montreal to start your career. You're from Vermont.
Yeah, I'm from Vermont, yeah, in Montpelier.
So were you guys studying at the same time and that's how you met, or are you kind of both part of the circus student community in the city?
Yeah, we're both part of the same community of students from the school, but we didn't go at the same time. I finished in 2016.
And I, like, auditioned in 2016, so we crossed paths then, and then just keep crossing each other, and just, I don't know, fall in love.
Oh, that's so awesome. I was kind of waiting for you to say it. Of course, it takes so much more to really make an artistic partnership work. Was it an automatic feeling where it was like, well, we're dating, we should also work together, or did it take time to come to that realization?
Straight away.
Yeah, we wanted to. We had like a similar flavor for things, and we knew from the beginning we wanted to make some stuff together. And
just like out of wanting to have fun, and then we kept like realizing we're having such similar ideas, and that it was like, oh, I want to try this thing and try this thing, and it was like this sort of like unstoppable desire to make some work together.
That's so awesome. And you were also saying, Sandy, that you both were kind of circus kids to begin with, right? Like,
like I grew up in a little tent circus in Western Australia, and
I grew up in the tent circus in Vermont.
Yeah, and we're like on the other side of the world from one another, but we're just kind of having this very like niche but very similar upbringing in like dusty tent circus, slightly traditional, a little bit punk, like pretty fun.
And that upbringing for both of you, this slightly punk, dusty space, is that an inspiration of the template of what you want to be doing, or are you moving away from that?
I'd say it's worked itself in.
Yeah, it is funny because it's like at the beginning, we were all of our ideas like around this thing. And then but now that I look at it, I see like there's some soul of that, but I also am like, wow, it's really different. Mm-hmm. It's not dusty punk circus at all, but it's like I feel like there's energy in it that I like.
There's definitely a soul from that transcends into what we're doing now, and we're really happy about that actually. And there's some nostalgia there, nostalgia circus, and it's a fun flavor.
I'm speaking with Sandy Tugwood and Noah Nielsen, getting ready to present their debut show, Sandy and Noah, very aptly named, at La Chapelle this coming week. So I understand this has a flavor of the Western, but like an updated version of the Western genre. So how does the Western and circus arts kind of come together in your vision here?
Well, I'd say it's more of the Western and like the feeling of the show. It's, it has this kind of lonesome dysfunctionality to it. It's kind of, the characters are in a situation where there's something kind of seemingly wrong, and there's something seemingly lonesome going on. And
for me, like, that really accentuates like the care between the characters. And the we got to this place during our creation where we're finding like a lot of like the symbols and motifs from like old West or like these Western stories sort of felt like very interesting to incorporate into this sort of like care between these characters in this sort of like sparse and like sort of dysfunctional world where, you know, like it just felt like kind of interesting to like place this these Western motifs on top of that to kind of like show these old values that aren't really like in existence in this world. Like there is no
there isn't space for those characters that don't really have the thing that they used to be doing
anymore. Yeah, those classic values no longer have the meaning that they do in this world, but kind of like trying to juxtapose, I guess, that those Western motifs with this like sort of ambiguous moral society-ish that we're living in.
Right, because I think when we think of Westerns, we think very clear, there's a bad guy and there's a good guy, yeah, and there's honor. Great. And they're standing up for yourself or standing up for someone who might be weaker. But in the world that you've envisioned, the lines are a little more blurry, but yet your two characters are kind of hanging on to those old ideas.
Yeah, there's this like embodying a character that should like have those values and ideas, but like actually showing care and like softness in those characters.
So we meet two personas. We have a cowboy, and then we have what you've called a wine guzzler, a backbend wine guzzler. So who's playing who? And tell me just a little bit of what we meet from these two characters when they kind of collide.
Yeah. Well,
I will say the show has changed a bit since the description.
Okay, but fair. Yeah. Allowed. But, that's totally allowed.
But the energy of those characters remain.
There's these characters and they're stuck in these certain walks. One is bent forward and one's bent backward. And
Noah is the cowboy on the way back from the grocery store. I'm the backbent wine guzzler.
And these are our own terms. I applaud anyone who's able to understand that from watching our show. There's no cowboy hat and there's no bottle of wine. These are just fun things that are guiding us.
But it is this thing where, like, you know, it's like, leaning towards sort of like, these characters that. Oh, I don't know how to get into that. Sorry.
Not at all. It's so much easier, I think, to have the image in your mind than actually have to put it into words. It's something else entirely.
It's actually, you know, I was doing like this pouring thing where I was like, there's this like indoor scene, and it's like we were working with like, oh, what if we're pouring with wine and stuff like that, and then it's like, maybe we'll just translate this into another motif instead of like wine or like the cowboy, but like the kind of essence of that, what we were trying to get at with those things, we're trying to keep, if that makes sense.
I have a random question for both of you, and I'm speaking with Noah and Sandy, who are getting ready to present. I don't know why I'm reversing them. You are Sandy and Noah. Sandy Tugwood and Noah Nielsen joining me to talk about their debut show coming to La Chapelle next week. in circus school, as you both studied here in Montreal, do you ever have to actually write down and verbalize, like, when you're doing character development, like does that part of your studies is like learning to kind of I imagine this is like probably day one at theater school for playwriting, but is that part of your studies as well?
We do a little bit of drama at that school, and you know, you kind of like learn, you know, very like a basic level of like, you know, you put a mask on and you learn how to like take on a certain feeling that character has, but yeah, not to the level of like the theater school. So yeah, it was actually like a kind of, well, new for me in this project trying to take on a character, whereas Noah is actually really good with character work, right? You've been doing that since, like, you know, you were in your youth circus, like.
Yeah, this show is actually fun for me to do a bit of character work for kind of like the first time at this scale. I have a couple lines, and it's been, yeah, really, really a joy working with that.
You both have worked for much bigger productions, Les Sept Doigts, Circa, Cirque du Soleil, and here you are, you know, working on your independent piece, your debut. Like, how does that feel to have all that control? It must be exciting, but also intimidating.
Yeah, it's really exciting. It's
We were just talking about it today, actually. We were like, wow, it's really hard. It's so hard to make a show.
There's a lot of extra pieces. You know, we're definitely not the most organized crew, yeah, it's been, but definitely having the freedom to express our own creation has been super exciting.
Yeah, and it's also like made us feel like really close, I guess. Like we just spend all day like sharing ideas, and then we go home and we're like, oh, what should this next scene be about, and like we can't stop talking about it, which maybe sometimes gets a bit much, but mostly I think it's fun to just have someone to constantly kind of like keep you thinking about the next thing you could be working on.
Yeah, you're fully immersed into the creative process because you don't just leave it at the office, so to speak. Another fun component of this show that you've named for yourselves, Sandy and Noah, is that your props have a really personal bent to it. I understand that a lot of the things that you'll be using and that we'll be seeing are personal.
Yeah. There's some set pieces that I grew up with, as well as we have a large granite bowl that a friend of ours carved. That's an integral prop in the show. And as well as costume pieces that have been made by both friends and myself, and much more. That was a bit of an accident, but also a bit inevitable. It felt, and yeah, we're happy with how that turned out. It feels intimate for us to perform.
It's fun to look back and like realize that all of our set pieces are just like actually really special items for both of us, so yeah, feels good.
A special touch for a new show of the launching of your duo. It's a really exciting time.
Yeah, super. Super, yeah, excited.
Very thrilled.
Thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with me. It's been a pleasure getting to know you.
Great.
Thank you
so much.
That was Sandy and Noah. That is what they're calling their circus duo. She is Sandy Tugwood from Margaret River on the west coast of Australia, and Noah Nielsen from Montpelier, Vermont. They co-created this show, the design, as well as the technical direction. They met at l'École Nationale du Cirque here in Montreal and are set to launch this show together Tuesday at La Chapelle Sainte Contemporaine, two shows later in the week, the 22nd and the 23rd. For tickets and more information, visit lachapelle.org. Call 514-843-7738 or email beatrice@lachapelle.org. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Tonight you heard Audrey Zina Mandiela, director of Pipeline, opening tonight at La Licorne. Playwright Miranda Rose Hall, She's behind a play for the living in a time of extinction coming to Centaur later this month. And Sandy Tugwood and Nick Nielsen, two circus artists, debuting their first show together at La Chapelle Saint Contemporaine next week. A very big thank you to my guests. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at ckut.ca under the archives. Big thank you to Jack Solar, our spoken word coordinator, for making sure this show gets to air. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeA. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca. If you are observing, a very happy Ramadan, a very happy Easter, a very happy Passover. Have fun and stay safe this long weekend. Up next is Grey Matters.
Good evening and welcome to the April 14th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show we have a debate entitled Can Capitalism Be Fixed? It was recorded in London on October 4th, 2021. The two debaters are Gillian Tett, who is an award-winning journalist at the Financial Times, where she is chair of the editorial board and U.S. editor-at-large. She is author of The Silo Effect, Fool's Gold, and Anthrovision. She's debating Yanis Varoufakis, who is a member of the Greek Parliament. He served as the finance minister of Greece in 2015, and he is the founder of MERA25, a progressive Greek political party. He's the author of many books, including Adults in the Room and another Now. So, here's tonight's lecture on Grey Matters. Can capitalism... Oh,